Welcome to the Real Estate Wealth Podcast, the show about how you can build wealth by investing in real estate. I'm your host, Ed Aloy, founder and CEO of CalCap Advisors. I'll dive deep into multifamily investing and today's current market. I'll also help you acquire the knowledge and tools necessary to generate passive income for life through discussions with friends and experts in the industry. Today, I have the honor and privilege of speaking with Charlie Engel. Charlie is an ultramarathon runner and adventure athlete. He has competed in many endurance challenges, including the Badwater Ultramarathon, which bills itself as the most demanding and extreme running race on the planet. But he is probably best known for running 4,500 miles across the Sahara Desert. Matt Damon made a documentary about this called Running the Sahara. Charlie and two friends ran the equivalent of, get this, 2 marathons per day for 111 consecutive days without taking a break. He is a recovering addict and says his greatest challenge is the one he takes every day, sobriety. Charlie's been clean and sober now since 1992. He is a sought-after motivational speaker and the author of the book Running Man. Charlie, welcome to the Real Estate Wealth Podcast. Did I get it all?
That's all there is. It was great being here. I'll talk to you later. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've had a very interesting life of really extreme highs and extreme lows. Can you give our listeners kind of a brief overview in your words of who Charlie Engel really is?
For me, I grew up in North Carolina. Went to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, thinking I was pretty awesome. And, you know, I got there and realized that there were 4,000 other freshmen with pretty much the exact same resume that I had. When I went to college, the drinking age was still 18. And so I did find something, in fact, Ed, that I was very good at in college, and that was drinking. And it was also the early 80s, and so as I call it, the cocaine decade. And, you know, I fell into this pattern of a lot of, you know, partying. And while some of my friends were able to do that kind of thing and still go to class and get through college, and it was just a phase, that phase for me lasted, you know, over a decade. And, you know, throughout my 20s, I led every company I ever worked for in sales, and, you know, I managed to look good on the outside and, you know, buy a house and have good cars. And on the inside, I was numb, and I used drugs and alcohol to continue that for me every day. And, you know, and I tried to quit. You know, I tried hard to make changes in my life. I went to rehab, and I went to church, and I tried all kinds of things to outside of me to get that pain, if you will, to go away. And, you know, it just wouldn't. And then my first son was born, and, you know, and I finally found a path to realizing that quite simply nobody was coming to save me, and that, you know, I needed to make a decision to change my own life. And I did that, and I started going to meetings, and I started running. And, you know, both of those two things really turned my life around. And, you know, ultimately I ended up being, for a while, at least the top ultra distance, long distance runner in the world. And I managed to do some pretty cool things and set some records and raise a family and, you know, kind of find my way to really a much better life. You know, I like to do really hard things, and I think there's huge value in taking on hard physical challenges, but also hard business and family related challenges. And, you know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. So I think that gives us a good starting point.
Mm-hmm. It seems like you traded sort of one really negative addiction for a completely different positive addiction, right? When you started running, I mean, do you think in a way you were kind of running from yourself? I know that sounds weird, but did that motivate you to just get away and escape, but really you were kind of running away from who you were at the time?
I would say it's the opposite. Anyone who's ever, you know, exercised and really focused on physical well-being. In fact, what you do is draw yourself much, much closer to who you really are. And so I think, in fact, it's really the opposite of that. And, you know, interestingly enough, when I did get sober, there were people in my life, even family, who sort of accused me, if you will, not so much in a mean way, but of switching addictions. And, you know, my joke was always that I've never like pawned my computer or sold my car to enter a marathon. So I'm pretty sure that this is better. And I also would say, and I think this will speak to your audience, you know, and by the way, everyone listening to this knows what we're talking about when we talk about addiction, because you've either struggled yourself, you have a family member, a close friend, someone who works with you that has struggled with addiction, and you probably know someone who's lost their battle with addiction. And, you know, so this is not a topic that people, you know, lack knowledge on. And I literally spent 3 years at, when I got sober, I went to a meeting every single day without missing a day. And I also did a run every day for 3 straight years without missing one single day. And I believe in the power of habits and, you know, positive momentum. And what I actually learned in that time period was I didn't need to get rid of the addictive part of my nature. That addictive, obsessive, even part of me is actually what makes me really good at things. As much as we strive for balance in the world today, you know, you don't really get good at something, whether it's real estate or a physical attribute or whatever it might be, unless you have at least a period of obsession where it's the first thing you're thinking of when your eyes open in the morning and the last thing you're thinking of when your head hits the pillow. And I would posit that in all likelihood, a lot of the listeners to this have an obsessive nature, if not addictive. So I do believe that, you know, I can actually say there's not one single negative side effect to the, you know, the physical undertaking that, you know, I decided to make part of my life in 1992.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. As an entrepreneur, right, like starting this company back in 2008, it did become an obsession for me. And, you know, people kind of don't realize, but as the entrepreneur, you never really let go, right? When you go home at night, no matter if you're not physically in the office, you're always focused and thinking about the company and the business. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah, I think you have to.
When I was talking about your running, I think, you know, what I was referring to were you sort of running from the addiction part of you towards a better you.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. You know, and look, I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, what I knew was, you know, I was going to die if I kept doing what I was doing. Like, there was simply no doubt about that. So, you know, I needed to find this new path.
When I started this company, you know, you can imagine all the people that were naysayers, like, oh, you're crazy. Why would you do that? Right. And again, you know, and a lot of those people, former coworkers, are kind of doing, you know, our old job of what we were doing 20 years ago, because it comes down to fear, I think, to a certain extent, and the fear of losing, you know, you, right? It's a combination.
Completely. Yeah. Well, they're not ready to work on themselves. And I always say it, a lot of those anchors that I unhooked early in my sobriety, they came back to me, you know, many of them years later, you know, coming to me and saying, hey, you know, I need to quit drinking, or I need to quit this particular negative habit. Can you help me? And, you know, and I think that's what I like to call attraction rather than promotion. I'm mm-hmm. sure it happens in your business too. You know, you leave some people behind because, you know, you just have to sometimes. But probably, knowing you for the brief time I've known you, if that person called you up 5 years later and said, hey, you know, I really want, you know, some of what you got and I'm willing to work hard for it, can you help me? Then it's like, all right, let's do this.
Right. And you'd be amazed, right, when you think about people that have success in any area of your life, they're always willing to help and bring up the folks that they left behind, if that's the case, right? So it's like people try to bring you down early, but then you have an opportunity to actually bring them up later, which is the most rewarding thing. And I'm sure you've done that probably with many, many people who came to you struggling with addiction, and now they're not because of you.
100%. And I mean, it's the most satisfying thing. My very first sponsor all those years ago, he was, you know, I was 29, he was in his mid 70s, and he said this one saying to me over and over, and it was very simple: to keep it, you have to give it away. Mm-hmm. And it stuck with me forever. And it's this, just this concept that, you know, whatever gift you have, you know, art, music, business, money, I mean, it could be anything, but like whatever you have, if you're not freely, you know, offering it up to other people in some fashion, some form, and not expecting a big return on that, then, you know, what is the point of accumulating that skill? There's so many outside pressures on every other aspect of our life, our business, our family, and just the involvement of other human beings. But each of us has this ability to, you know, to live a healthy, you know, physically productive life, yet the vast majority of people, especially here in the U.S., just choose not to.
100%. Yep.
And look, we all grew up running, right? We're kids. We couldn't stop us from running. And then we go to middle school and some PE teacher, you know, uses running as a punishment when we're 12 years old. And all of a sudden we hate running.
That's exactly right. Although I've never been a runner, I got to admit, I've never loved running. I like the stopping part, like you mentioned as well. A lot more in terms of distance. Charlie, back to kind of the addiction story and you falling into the trap of drugs, I guess, in college, right? Maybe just sort of partying innocently at the beginning and then kind of fell deeper and deeper into the trap, it sounds like. What ultimately sort of motivated you? I think you mentioned your son being born, but was there sort of an epiphany or a defining moment that you remember where you're like, this is it, not another day, I can't do this anymore?
Yeah, well, it's very simple. It was a couple months into my son's life. And, you know, for no reason, I found myself driving, you know, to the worst neighborhood in town. Like nothing happened. I didn't, no argument, no job issue or whatever. I just ended up in a place I'd been many, many times. And I spent 6 days, you know, basically killing myself with drugs and alcohol. And, you know, that binge ended with me, you know, handcuffed on the ground with the police searching my car, and there's like bullet holes in my car. I mean, this was a, you know, an epic situation. And, you know, and I just remember, and I said it a moment ago, but I remember that thinking feeling of, I think, always wanting something outside of me to force me into making a decision about my own health and my sobriety. And, you know, and I finally realized in that moment, you know, that, you know, nobody was coming to save me. You know, there was no, and I think that's true in all things. You know, we all have, most of us have support systems that include a lot of family and friends who would be more than willing and happy to support us and help us get through a hard time. But the reality is, no matter what the decision is, it has to start with me. And so, that was the night that I'm sitting there on the ground thinking, well, you know, I'm going to die if I keep doing this. I'm not going to raise a son. I'm not going to have a life. And you know, and that was the night that I went to, you know, an AA meeting, first real one I'd ever gone to. And I got up the next day and I went for a run. And that, you know, that started my 3-year streak. And I just knew I had no plan at all. And yet, something inside me told me that if I just did those two things every day and I treated that routine like gold and I didn't get lazy, that routine would yield results. And it did. You know, it changed everything and made me, you know, who I am today.
That's amazing. The story of the bullet holes is amazing too.
Yeah, they were shooting at me too. They weren't mad at my car. So it was, as far as I know. So it was lucky, you know, lucky and eye-opening.
Yeah, so that's, I think, a good segue. Let's talk a little bit about your time in prison. Can you kind of give our listeners a little backdrop of what happened, how you ended up there, and what that experience was like and what you took away from it?
Absolutely. First of all, none of this is an endorsement of federal prison. I don't recommend it. And, but, you know, look, and life had gotten very good for me. You know, I was the senior producer for a TV show called Extreme Makeover Home Edition for many years. You know, I was a top ranked athlete in the world in my sport. I was, you know, things were going well. And I did this big project with Matt Damon where I ran across the Sahara Desert. And you talked about that a little bit in the intro, and partnered with Matt Damon to create what today is called water.org. Which is the world's largest clean water nonprofit. So that you know, that nonprofit was born out of the idea that running across the Sahara Desert would be an idea that had any value at all. So I always like to remind people that sometimes the things that sound crazy, you're like, why would you do that? Like, what's the reasoning behind that? Well, the reasoning is you don't know what's going to happen. And very often, if you put yourself out vulnerably to people and allow them an opportunity to follow and to support you, you know, you can lead people to great things. And, you know, and I learned that lesson a long time ago. So when I came back from the Sahara and signed with an agent and started doing a lot of speaking, and I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I was out just running errands one day, and I came back to my condo, and six armed federal agents, you know, with guns drawn, you know, arrested me and put me in the back of a police car and took me to jail in downtown Greensboro. And this was, needless to say, the biggest surprise of my life. And I sat there all night, and the next morning I was handed a big stack of papers, and it was a federal indictment. And as I like to say, one single IRS agent in Greensboro, North Carolina, saw the film Running the Sahara, and he was not impressed. And for context, this was 2010, early 2010, so that people understand, you know, the timing, and that'll be important as I continue the story. But, you know, ultimately, it was an investigation into my taxes. Like, he saw the movie, and he's like, oh, I want to see how a runner can afford to do this. And my joke is always that apparently he'd never heard of Matt Damon, because I certainly wasn't funding the thing. But, you know, and there is a memo in my file, because this thing actually went to trial, and the memo says, you know, Mr. Engel pays his taxes. And there was one year where, like, as a self-employed person, I possibly might have underpaid by $3,000. But, like, that was the extent of all that came out of it. But instead of quitting at that point, this particular agent sent in an undercover. He used the Patriot Act to actually dumpster dive and surveil my emails and phone and my friends and family. And, you know, ultimately I end up being the only person in the U.S. at that time, the only borrower to be charged with overstating my income on a home loan application. And by the way, this is obviously an educated real estate crowd. So this was a ninja loan.
Yep.
From 2005. So the loan itself was from, you know, the heart of the the mess we found ourselves in 2005. And, you know, and for this, you know, supposed crime, I could be sentenced to 20 years in federal prison. And look, I made a decision to fight this at trial, and nobody does that against the feds. And there were, you know, a variety of reasons. But, you know, one of the reasons I made for a good target is I had just enough notoriety to be interesting, but not nearly enough money to defend myself. So, you know, I ended up with a public defender, but, you know, I had a father in real estate, and I knew enough about real estate after buying and selling my own properties through the years that I needed to fight this thing. And so I did make a decision to, you know, to fight it, because I knew I hadn't done it. And a couple of interesting nuances I'm just going to interject here, because it's worth noting at this point, and all of this kind of just it became really evident years later, but in 2010, there was a big push to find people to blame for the mortgage meltdown. And certainly the government wasn't going to point the finger at itself, who ultimately was the real culprit. But
yes, as you know, I lived through that world, right? Having worked for one of the biggest mortgage banks in the country during the time that actually failed. And the Barney Franks of the world saying everyone deserves to be in a home didn't quite work out, because it turns out everyone wasn't responsible enough to be in a home.
No, it did not. Well, if you just set aside all due diligence and everything else, I mean, the joke, I mean, I wasn't even a real estate person, but the joke was, you know, if you had a pulse, you could get a loan.
Right.
And ultimately, I think that turned out to be an understatement. There were loans and dogs' names and, like, whatever. So anyway, long story short, I go to trial, and my mortgage broker gets on the stand and actually admits that he forged the loan application in my name and signed my name to it. And, you know, for me, it was a ninja loan. I didn't even know there was a loan application in the package. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, with that type of loan, you know, I had a good enough credit score and I paid an extra point or point and a half. And like, I, you know, this was.
So it was a stated income loan. So there was nothing correct. Proven, but the income was stated and the mortgage broker stated an income without your awareness of some
exactly.
amount. Yeah. We used to always joke exactly. back then, you know, we would see so many stated income loans with gardeners or landscapers making $10,000 a month. It was always $10,000 a month that the brokers would put on the app, right?
Yep. Well, this guy put even more than that on mine, and I was making decent money. But you know, the fact of the matter is, I didn't do it. So people who hear about the trial would say, "Well, that's the end of it, then, right?" I mean, this guy got on the stand and he admitted to doing that. But the fact is, you know, the closing package sent from my attorney to me, I think most people would be pretty stretched to say that the average borrower, anyway, to say that they paid through every page of their fat stack of papers. You know, you trust your closing attorney to tell you where to sign. So anyway, I sign it and I send it back, and that becomes mail fraud. And I essentially I'm found guilty of mail fraud and sentenced to 21 months in federal prison in Beckley, West Virginia. Wow. And so I went to prison. My kids dropped me off on Valentine's Day in 2011. I'm not excited, needless to say. I'm scared and I'm sad, and I'm sad for them. And, you know, and I begin serving this sentence, and I'm also really pissed off. You know, I feel like an injustice has been done. And, you know, the first guy I really become close to in prison is early 60s black man who got a crazy long sentence for like a single gram of crack cocaine. And, you know, and perspective has a way of changing your view of things. You know, I realized that fair or unfair was not the point. And there were going to be 1,000 stories in that prison of people who actually were treated more unfairly than I was. And, you know, you and I talked at the very beginning of this podcast too about the nature of business. And anyone who doesn't think that the, you know, prison industrial complex is not a massive industry is really not paying attention. That's again a podcast for another day. But it was my opportunity to learn this. And I recognize that even in this terrible situation, that my happiness was still completely up to me. No one else could determine how I was going to feel, what I was going to do, and what my happiness level was going to be. So, you know, I did what I always do, and I started running. And I started running every day around this little track that was in the rec yard. And we would be on lockdown a lot of times, and I would run in place for an hour or 5 hours, you know, in my cell. And like, I look like a nut, but I always, the joke I always make is that if you're a middle-aged white guy in federal prison, looking like a nut is a pretty good strategy. Like people will not bother you.
Right.
And they gave me a wide berth. And, you know, and the next thing that happened though is the most amazing part. And it goes right back to attraction rather than promotion. For a while, people made fun of me, like I was this, you know, crazy dude. And then my life actually got better in there. You know, I was writing every day. I read 150 books. I got like a book club that I started. I'm teaching people about addiction and recovery, because there is none of that in federal prison, despite the fact that everybody's in there for drugs. It's just it's a crazy, flawed system of punishment that sends people back out into society way worse than they were when they got there. Mm-hmm. So again, another unintended consequence. But you know, what happened is guys started coming up to me and saying, "Hey, can you teach me how to run? You know, can I?" Basically what they were saying to me was, "I see how you're getting through this and I want to feel that way." And by the time I ended up leaving, you know, a year and a half later, I had 50 guys in my running group, and we ran every single day. I had a dozen guys who lost more than 100 pounds. I had 25 guys doing yoga on the softball field with me 3 days a week. I mean, it was beautiful.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
I'll wrap it up by just saying, back to what my sponsor said, you know, to keep it, you have to give it away. The day I left prison, guys came up to me hugging me and thanking me for what I did for them. But in that same old lesson, I didn't do anything for them.
I'm a big believer in goal setting, which I'm sure you are too. And I think, you know, the effective thing of goal setting, and I learned this process actually from a Tony Robbins seminar, is, you know, you kind of start with the end in mind, you know, kind of like Stephen Covey said, but you know, you chunk down, right? So it's like you start with, okay, I want to make $100 million. Oh my God, that's overwhelming. Or I'm going to run 135 miles, overwhelming. But if you sort of chunk it down to, okay, what do I need to do this year, the next 6 months, this quarter, this week, today, to accomplish that goal? Is that kind of how you look at, I mean, you know, it's just so daunting when I hear you say you ran 4,500 miles across the Sahara. Like, I'm sure mentally you had to chunk that down into smaller bits, right?
100%. I had to focus. Well, it's funny you say it because we, you know, the first 7 days we actually fell apart out there in the Sahara. And a lot of it was because I was so attached to the outcome. Like all I could think about, because I felt a lot of pressure from investors and Hollywood, all I could think about was getting those 4,500 miles behind me. But you know what? That's not how it works, especially not with running. So, you know, by day seven, I basically had to just say, look, the only thing I'm thinking about this morning is running a marathon. Then I'm going to have a little break at lunch. And then the only thing I'm going to think about this afternoon is running a second marathon. And in that way, you know, I was able to slowly move across without getting overwhelmed by the enormity of the project. And I think that holds true for almost every big thing that we ever tackle.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to chunk it down into smaller bits and right and bring it forward into, okay, what do I need to do today to get through this long-term goal?
Otherwise, we would just throw our hands up and, you know, run screaming in the other direction because it's just too much. You know, that is the trick, man. That is the trick.
Charlie, you talk a lot about suffering and how it's so important for people. And I agree with you. I'm actually a big Bruce Lee fan. I recently got my black belt in Taekwondo at 58, which I'm pretty proud
nice.
Of. Yeah.
Very
it was
good.
A nice accomplishment, kind of a COVID. I turned my garage into a gym and it was a good time to accomplish that goal. But I have a saying in my office, a Bruce Lee saying that says, don't pray for an easy life. Pray for the strength to endure a difficult one, which, you know, I really believe is true. And I kind of try to tell my kids this, which they get annoyed with, but you know, life throws curveballs, right? And you got to be prepared because it's not an easy life. My oldest son has autism, right? And so I'll remember the day when he was just over his second birthday and my wife and I were there with the therapist and she gave us the diagnosis, right? And we were just devastated. And it's, you know, a curveball and life hits you over the head when things are going great. You know, you got to be aware because somehow life's going to hit you over the head again, right? And give you a reality check, which I think leads to growth. I mean, the suffering leads to growth, which is why we're here. Do you kind of want to speak to that and give me your thoughts around that topic?
Man, you said so much and really beautiful things. I love that Bruce Lee quote. And it's so true. And look, you know, I speak to parents all the time and very often a lot of wealth groups, a lot of real estate groups, a lot of, you know, and there's always questions about generational wealth. And, you know, I am pretty outspoken about, you know, number one, not being a, you know, a snowplow for your kids, you know, so inevitably in person, someone will raise their hands and say, you know, but I just want my kids to have it easier than I had when I was growing up.
Right.
And I always say, why? What do you have against your kids? Right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, everybody, you can ask anybody this direct question. Would you say that the hardships that you faced in your life have made you the person that you are today?
Yes.
And everyone says yes. Of course we do. So why would we want to? No, I'm not, you know, yeah, get your kid out of the middle of the street or don't, you know, I'm not talking about crazy decisions, but normal difficulties. I mean, now autism, of course, is a whole different, you know, challenge, but one that I'm sure just speaking to you for this time that you've found a way to make it a positive part of your life and to give your son the best life that he can possibly have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when we got that diagnosis, we're like, okay, we're not going to deny the diagnosis, but we can defy, you know, the ultimate outcome here. And we've thrown everything at it. My wife has worked tirelessly and he's come a really, really long way.
Amazing.
Yeah. He's a blessing, right? Like we see him as a blessing and he's opened up parts of me and parts of my personality that probably, you know, emotionally were locked in and would have never opened up. So
And it is. It's your family's path. And, you know, to spend or waste time, as I say, you know, bemoaning the path is to ignore the opportunity. And, you know, I'm not saying every minute, you know, I'll be honest, you know, my wife had cancer for over 6 years, and we're very much in the heart of a very serious battle for her, you know, life and existence. And so I live it literally every single day. And I'm not here to tell you that I do a great job of it all the time. You know, I can talk the talk, but it's not always easy, of course, when you're, you know, in the middle of it all the time, to live up to your own standards and expectations. But just being aware of them is a big part of the challenge. You know, and getting to the heart of things, Ed, you know, you everyone struggles. You know, success looks different for everybody, but struggle comes in a few basic buckets. You know, it's physical, it's relationships, it's, you know, there's really just a few things, and almost every problem any of us has fits in those couple of categories. But, you know, success is, looks a million different ways, but it's finding a way to realize in your life that there's never going to be a minute where you don't have a big pile of unresolved problems. It just doesn't happen. We all have them. Like, if you're a person out there trying to be your best self and make an impact and, you know, support your family and be physically fit and all of those things, you know, you're always going to have a big pile of, I just call them, unpaid bills, metaphorically speaking. And you have to learn to be okay with that. Like, you have to find a way to be happy and content and satisfied and know those challenges are always going to be sitting there. And yes, you have to deal with them, but, you know, not allowing them to dominate your life. People will watch you and they will emulate your behavior long before they will quote your actual words, because that's the truth. You know, are you doing what you're saying, or are you just saying things? And, you know, it's human nature, but it's a beautiful thing. You know, if you're actually doing the thing, you don't even need to tell people. They see it, and it cues them on how they should behave in the same situation.
Right, exactly. Well, Charlie, I appreciate you taking the time today. I think we need to kind of wrap the show here, but gosh, that was really an exhilarating and interesting conversation. I love your perspective on things. I know this is a real estate podcast, so we kind of went off in a little direction, but, you know, you and I both know that mindset is so critically important in how people look at obstacles in their way and overcoming them, and really, you know, like you said, embracing, you know, the struggles, right? Not running from them, but you have to embrace them, and you have to say, okay, no one's coming here to save me now, but it's up to me, and I'm empowered to control it and do what I need to do. And I think that's the message for anything we do in life, ultimately.
That's it. Well, I'm so glad I got a chance to speak with you. And I'll leave you with one final thought. And I say it on every talk I ever give, but, you know, what happens to us isn't nearly as important as what we do about it. You know, good and bad things are going to happen to every single person. And it's, you know, the whether it turns out to be something positive, it's completely up to us and how we go about tackling that obstacle. And it's part of life, and giving yourself over to it is way easier than fighting it. And it doesn't matter what situation in your life you're in, if you can boil it down to what's right in front of you, and even though you got two other big problems that are going to be there the next day or the next week, focus on the one that you're dealing with right this minute. And it's shocking how often that will actually set in motion a plan and solution for all the rest of it.
That's right. I mean, there's the outer world that we can't control, but there's the inner world that we 100% can control. And I think that's really the message here. So thanks again, Charlie. Appreciate your time. CharlieEngle.com if you want to learn more about what he's up to. I hope today's show inspired you just a little bit, and would like to thank my guests again. I'm excited to bring you more episodes with interesting and informative experts to help you navigate your way to wealth in real estate investing.
Thanks for listening to the Real Estate Wealth Podcast. The Real Estate Wealth Podcast is produced by Gusto, a Matter Company. Our producer and audio engineer is Jeanette Harris-Kortz, with support from Gabe Garzon and Susan Rangel. Maya LaPearl is our writer. For show notes and more information about this podcast, visit edalloy.com. And for more information about CalCap Advisors, visit us at www.calcap.com or follow us on Twitter at CalCap Advisors.
I'm your host, Ed Alloy, and thank you for listening.